You are listening to Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are. We now present Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello.
Thank you, Nick. It's Ask the Lawyer program, Joe Martinello, here in the Radio Maria studios with our good friend and colleague, Vince DeAngelis. Vince, how are you today?
I'm well, thank you, Joe. How are
Very
you?
Good, good. So today we're, our last program we had talked, I called it Wills, Powers of Attorney, and Estate Planning Part 1. Part 2, we're going to probably try to deal today so that the listeners are aware of what we're going to talk about. We're going to be talking about things that are sort of important this time of year that relate also to tax planning, and talk about tax-free savings account, registered retirement savings plans, and if we have time also on registered education savings plans, which are so important for so many families and listeners, old and young alike, to understand. We'd like to remind all the listeners that the Radio Maria programs that are presented are, of course, brought with a view to having all of the listeners participate, if they so wish, either by way of a comment or a question on any of the areas that we're talking about. And so there is a call-in number for those people who wish to call Radio Maria. Nick and our broadcast booth here will help us. But the phone number is area code 416, which is a Toronto area code, 416-245-1534. I repeat, area code 416, which is in the Toronto area. The number is 245-1534. And for those who are listening by phone, we want to encourage people, if they don't have access to a computer, that they can listen to Radio Maria on phone by the use of, once again, phone number, area code 647-557-1011. And that's Radio Maria on phone, 647-557-1011. So we'll call it Estate Planning Part 2. It's getting around the tax season, which everybody doesn't like to deal with, but taxes are unfortunately an inevitable part of life. As the old joke used to be, death and taxes were the only two certainties in life, and so we're moving to that thing, and we see, especially now, we're going to see a lot of marketing endeavors by financial institutions, particularly with RRSPs, and you know, some of the things that we look at as lawyers is we have clients who regularly come in to view their estate planning goals and change their wills, or they feel their wills are old, or in powers of attorney, or some life-changing event has occurred, a child has died, or a parent has died. And what happened in the last couple of weeks, Vince, for me was I had a client who I thought was very sophisticated, and when we were going through our wills and estates information sheet, you know, that information sheet that we all like to use so we actually know our client, as we say, we can actually, because it's really important for us as lawyers, which we mentioned in our program last time, to not look at things in a void, but to understand what it is that our clients have and do so we can give them the best possible advice. And this one particular client we were going through, and when I said the word tax-free savings account, it's like her eyes glossed over. It's like I was speaking another language, so I thought, well, maybe I should say something like TFSA, which we all as lawyers hear about, and it was like I was speaking Greek, not even Italian. As a matter of fact, she was Greek. So, and I was surprised that someone who we all think, you know, is a relatively intelligent person and as our clients are and so on, absolutely, it turned out, she knew absolutely nothing about tax-free savings accounts. So you could say, well, maybe she's the odd case, but I think the important thing is that how important it is for not only our radio broadcasts and everything, but everything even you see in advertising, understand what is a tax-free savings account? How does it work? Does it make sense in an estate planning context or not? Vince, what do you think about tax-free savings accounts, which are fairly new? They didn't exist more than 5 years ago. And maybe that's another reason that a lot of people are not aware of them, because maybe they did a will 20 years ago and they never discussed it again with their lawyers or their financial planners. What's your feeling on tax-free savings accounts?
Well, first of all, as a lawyer, I don't give clients financial planning advice. So they may have questions about what the product is and whether it's a good fit for them. I think it's something that they should discuss with their financial advisor. I can only advise on the legal consequences, and my focus is more on what happens on the death of the TFSA owner. Having said that, I think the biggest obstacle towards TFSAs is the money. You know, a lot of people just don't have enough money to put away into TFSAs, especially if they're contributing to their RSPs or maximizing their contributions. A lot of people are borrowing money. So it's really those who have the excess cash.
And the actual amount that someone this year in 2018, because it's a relatively new program, the actual amount of the TFSA that one can use an individual, I think, is roughly $57,500.
Yeah, we're about close to $60,000 or so. It's been around, I believe, since 2009. And the annual contributions, except for 1 year, were about $5,500. Right. So if you've been contributing every year for the last 9 years or so, then you'd probably be building up quite a nice amount. And the benefit of the TFSA is, again, if you have the money to put away, is that it accumulates and grows tax-free. So provided it's within the authorized investments, because even the Income Tax Act has certain restrictions on the types of investments that the money's going to be put into. But to the extent that that money grows in value, it's growing tax-free and you can take it out tax-free. The contributions are not tax deductible. And so, again, that further makes it a bit of an impediment to contribute, because if you do have money to contribute, that's great. But if you don't, and if you're borrowing money to contribute, don't expect to get anything back from the government because it's non-refundable.
Now, how does that, because I think you've highlighted some of the important issues, and how do you see that compared to, for example, the Registered Retirement Savings Plans, or the RRSPs, as we call them? You were pointing out, now the RRSPs are tax deductible, so that if I contribute $100 into my RRSP, I will be able to deduct it, assuming it's part of my limit, that within that limit, from my income tax in a current year. But a lot of people say, well, why would I even bother to put money into an RRSP? What's the benefit to me going forward? I mean, you know, if I put a lot of money into an RRSP and something happens to me, it's going to be taxed at a really high rate of tax. What happens if somebody tells you that, or they say to you something like that to you? How do you deal with that?
Well, for many Canadians, they don't have, they're not part of a pension plan at work. So really the only sources of income after retirement are the Canada Pension Plan and Old Age Security, which I'm sure you'll agree isn't going to be very much, and probably not going to allow you to maintain your accustomed standard of living.
And a lot of people, I guess, don't realize, Vince, that the old age security, as we call it, was really designed many, many years ago here in Canada to basically ensure that seniors sort of reach the poverty level, right? I mean, it's the very low level of income. I think between Canada Pension Plan and old age security, you'd probably be lucky to even reach $2,000 a month.
Especially if you're a single senior, it's a very, very low amount. So I see an RRSP as a supplement, a necessary supplement to your savings retirement plan, if you will. And in fact, I see it as a sort of a forced savings, because it's money you should put away and forget about it. Not forget about in the sense of not reviewing the investment strategy and plan with your financial advisor, but in the sense of not touching that money to the extent that you can. I mean, there's home buyers plans and so forth that allow you to borrow from your RRSP. But if you can avoid doing that, and allow that money to grow, I see it as a supplement to your pension income.
Yeah, and when you're much older, you may well have a need because, like you said, absent a pension plan, you're going to have your own pension plan, for want of a better word, to give yourself a little bit better quality of life when you're older.
Exactly. So people gripe about the fact that, well, when they take the money out, they're paying tax on it. But again, I believe it's at 71, it's converted into what's called a registered retirement income fund. And at that point, there's minimal annual withdrawals that are required. However, if you don't have a very high income to begin with, the taxes will be minimal. The benefit of the RSP, though, is in your working years, you make that contribution subject to your annual limit. And to the extent that you don't make your maximum contribution for a year, you can make that contribution in later years. And you can deduct your contributions. The contributions are tax deductible, so you get some of that money back. And the growth in the RSP during the lifetime of that RSP is tax-free. You only pay taxes when you take that out, either on death or when you turn 71, it's converted to a RIF and you're taking monies out on an annual basis.
And a lot of accountants, of course, always, they have these famous sayings that lawyers maybe agree or don't agree with, but the accountants always say that a tax dollar deferred is a tax dollar earned, right? They always are big into deferral. And that's certainly the case on the RSP, that basically, as you said, if you're earning something within that RSP fund, you're not being taxed on it today. So it's being deferred and it's allowing it to to grow, hopefully, and be compounded over a long period of time when you'll need it. And I guess, though, you get the same benefit out of the TFSA, right? Except it's more like a bank account. You can draw that out. There's no tax benefit going in and there's no tax benefit going out of the tax-free savings account.
Well, the TFSA has a big advantage over the RSP in the sense that none of the income that grows or none of the growth in capital or income is taxable. So you get all of that money back. With the RSP, the benefit of the RSP is you get the initial deduction, and over the life of the RSP, any monies, any income or capital that's accruing in that plan is tax-free. It's only taxable when you take it out. So I'll give you an example. Let's say you have $100,000 in income from an investment. If you're paying taxes at the top marginal rate, you'd be paying about $50,000 in taxes that year. Mm-hmm. If it was in the RSP, no taxes would be payable until you took it out. So you've got an extra $50,000 that can be invested and in turn grow, earn income, and grow in capital. So yes, the deferral advantage is huge with an RSP, even though you're going to pay taxes when the monies are taken out.
Eventually. Now, Vince, another thing that I talked about with this lady that I told you about, because she didn't really know anything about tax-free savings accounts, and it reminded me, actually, when I was speaking to her, about when we do estate planning reviews of clients who have already tax-free savings account, how they're set up. And even with these clients, when I asked them, can you please bring in a copy of your latest statement? Of course, they're a little bit puzzled because they don't actually remember that statement coming in, even if they've invested. But one of the things we're wondering about is when the tax-free savings account first went into effect, and somebody would say, okay, well, if I have all this lump sum of money, what happens to it if I pass away in terms of estate planning? So what's available on the tax-free savings account from a legal perspective in terms of designating, if it's necessary, who gets the money in my tax-free savings account if I pass away tomorrow?
Well, you can do one of two things. If you have a spouse, which includes a common law spouse.
And Vince, the common law spouse, I'm just going by memory because I know that we have different standards. A common law spouse, I mean, aside from maybe having a child together, would be somebody that's cohabited with that person for a period of 3 years, correct?
Well, for income tax purposes, it's 1 year.
1 year for income tax purposes.
That's right.
Correct.
That's right. So the benefit is if you do have a spouse, you could name that spouse a successor holder. And upon your death, the surviving spouse can maintain your TFSA. And so...
So that sounds like you can, like, for want of a better word, double up, for want of a better word. So if, for example, with whether people are younger or older, but perhaps some of our older listeners would be wondering, oh, well, if I have, you know, this $57,500 and my husband also has it, well, what happens when he passes away? So what you're saying is essentially is that that capital amount can go to the surviving spouse as long as the person is mentioned as a successor holder in the tax-free savings account.
Exactly. And the alternative is to name a beneficiary. You name a beneficiary, just like the RSP, the proceeds are paid to that beneficiary. They avoid probate fees.
And now that's very important too. That this is part of, I guess, what we as lawyers look at and why we ask clients for a copy of their TFSA statements, because I've seen, and unfortunately in the past couple of years, even though the parent had children, they had made the estate the beneficiary. They told me in both cases on the advice of the bank person they went into. So what do you think about that kind of a situation? Let's say a spouse has passed away and you have children. So it's important in a review to make sure who are the beneficiaries in that case.
Well, exactly. And you can make the beneficiary designation either in the will or in the our TFSA contract itself.
Is there anything that's preferred, Vince, from your experience?
I prefer having it named in the contract itself, only because a designation in the will only applies to plans in existence that on the date that the will was prepared or signed. And a lot of people are under the impression, and they're misinformed, to think that, well, if they open another TFSA account, and a lot of people do, although they shouldn't, I think there should just be one.
Yeah, if only to keep things a bit more simple, right, and organized.
Simple, yeah. But that designation in the will won't apply to any after-acquired TFSA accounts.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I think a lot of people are under that misimpression for sure.
And the same applies for life insurance policy designations. It can also be made in the will. And so if you name the children as beneficiaries, although we're not quite there yet, although let's say your TFSA is worth, you know, $100,000 on death, you know, it's not a lot of money, but you save $1,500 in probate fees, about roughly 1.5%. So you can see just by making that very simple designation, you've just paid, you know, you just saved the estate, you know, some money. And that's only going to grow
as time goes on. What if in the two cases I mentioned, in your opinion, the beneficiary has been made the estate of Mr. Lawyer? Does that mean I have to probate it?
Well, it all depends. Some financial institutions are prepared to release funds to the executor where they aren't that large. But if you have an estate that has assets that do require probate, even one, then the value of that TFSA that's payable to the estate will also have to be included in calculating the probate fees.
So you're not going to be able to get around it. So I guess the lesson to be learned really on that situation is if you want, for example, in our example here, you want your kids to get the money directly is to actually nominate them as the beneficiaries under the TFSA. And to make sure that your designation is clearly indicated on the papers you've signed with the bank.
It's a very simple thing to do, and it could save the estate a lot of money. And it's an exercise I go through with my clients all of the time. Very often the statements they provide me with don't indicate who the beneficiary is or successor holder is. And there is the odd time, to the surprise of the clients, that they find out that they hadn't named a successor holder, hadn't named a beneficiary. So you can see that in the will preparation exercise, it's not just a matter of drafting a will, you're really taking an inventory of what the client has, and you force the client to do some housekeeping and making sure that their proper designations are in place.
And that's a really good point. We're gonna break for 1 minute, but we want to talk about this issue that in the context also of our RSPs, simplification and getting your house in order and getting organized, that Vince has just mentioned. And we'll be back in 1 minute to continue discussions on estate planning with a particular context on taxation. Thank you, Nick. Joe Martinello and Vista Angelis in the Radio Maria studios today, discussing wills, powers of attorney, estate planning, and with a little bit of an emphasis today on taxation issues because we're coming up to tax season. So, Vince, before the break, we talked a fair bit about the tax-free savings accounts, and we wanted to carry on talking about registered retirement savings plans. And in particular, I wanted to sort of the lead in with the issue about, you mentioned before about how we review what clients have and what their situation is, and then this whole issue of simplification and what to do. So we have registered retirement savings plans. My experience a lot of times is you get a client that I mentioned with this lady that I had, and it turns out she had like 10 registered retirement savings plans. And, you know, you look at it and you scratch your head. Do you not think that one of the first goals that we as lawyers, not that we prefer one financial institution over another, is to have clients simplify their lives in terms of how they're organized with RRSPs?
Well, again, it goes back to what I mentioned at the beginning of the program. My role is not to give the client financial planning advice. So there may be a reason why they're in different funds. Perhaps the client received advice that certain managers have different investment strategies that you know, the client wants to invest with various you know, funds that have, you know, managers with different investment strategies, and so they figure on the whole they may be ahead of the game if they have a diversified portfolio of plans. But what I find confusing oftentimes is the clients will have registered plans with different financial institutions. Why not have it with one? And you can have it in different plans with different managers. But again, it's perhaps the client's investment strategy, so I don't want to interfere with that. But I find very often that a lot of the registered plans are just GICs. Right, and they're with different financial institutions. And that's just cash. Yeah. So why do you have five or six different GICs with different financial institutions
doing exactly the same thing?
And maybe it's for insurance, deposit insurance purposes. Maybe it's CDIC. I don't know if there's it covers those plans as well. But I honestly think that the clients over the years just deal with different financial institutions. They sock away some money. And over a course of 20, 30 years, you look at their plate and there's all these different funds. And so I suggest to the clients that they have a financial review and consider consolidating everything into
right, make things
one or two
a little
plans.
Bit easier to administer and for themselves and for their heirs that they want to indicate such a thing. So on registered retirement savings plans, we talked about under the TFSAs about having successor holders who are spouses and beneficiaries. So can you explain a little bit to us registered retirement savings plans from a legal point of view? You mentioned very clearly that when you do a will, it only, if you do certain designations in a will, it only covers the plans in effect. And as we just mentioned now, people tend to do different plans after making a will and so on. So let's say today I have a registered retirement savings plan. So I've listened to my lawyer and suggested that, you know, it really shouldn't be part of the will, and there's a good reason about it, maybe a special reason. So now I have a registered retirement savings plan. So are there any benefits to me, for example, having that a beneficiary be my spouse or my kids or not? Or does it really make any difference at all?
Well, the benefit is where you have the beneficiary designated as the where the designated beneficiary is the spouse or an infirm or dependent child, then those proceeds can be rolled into, in the case of a spouse, their own RRSP, and the taxes will be deferred until the spouse either dies or takes the monies out. With infirm,
so that's also a big advantage, because the big knock on the RRSPs is that it immediately comes into your income, and if you have a large sum, it'll be taxed at a very high rate. But if you have a spouse and it's rolled over into that spouse's benefit, the long-term benefits of the RRSP carry on.
Exactly. So you've got the spouse has two piles or pots of money that they can rely on.
And that can be very important, right, Vince? I mean, you know, as lawyers, we tend to, you know, we look at things legalistically, but we all know that people in general are living a lot longer, and the cost of healthcare, attendant healthcare, and people who need help as they grow older are getting more substantial in real dollar terms.
Exactly. And you never know how much is enough for retirement. And so, again, you just can't rely on the government pension plans that are out there. And I think the government's recognized that because, as I understand it, the pension plan CPP contributions will be increasing next year. But I don't think that's enough. And you need to supplement that.
Right, because our Canada pension plan is not like some of the European plans, which tend to be where people pay a lot more money during their working lives into that plan. They're forced to. A forced savings feature, and therefore they have maybe more income available to them when they retire. In some countries they do that, whereas our system is a little bit different. We force people to pay through the Canada Pension Plan, which appears to be very well run, according to everything we read in the papers, but it provides a very minimal effort. And like you said, it's being increased, and that'll be a little bit better. But people still have a responsibility to take care of themselves. And so if we're all living longer, or we're married and we have our spouses are living longer, there'll be probably more monies unless we expect our kids to sort of take care of us somehow, which history teaches us is not likely to be too much of a probability anymore. Everybody's independent and everybody's more mobile in terms of the world. So you have to pretty much try to take care of yourself. So there's no real benefit, unless there's a special case, just nominating somebody RSP. What if I have an RSP at my bank and I decide I don't want my spouse to get that RSP. I'm going to nominate my kids as the beneficiaries of the RSP. Is that a good idea, a bad idea? What happens on that?
Well, again, unless you have an infirm or dependent child that's the beneficiary, the estate will end up paying the tax. And it's not a problem if the beneficiaries of the estate, the residual beneficiaries, that is those that will receive the estate, the other assets of the estate apart from the RSP, are the same as the ones who are receiving the RSP. The problem you get into is where you have the beneficiaries or a beneficiary of an RSP who is not the same as the residual beneficiaries, or there may be others in addition to the beneficiary of the RSP will be receiving a share of whatever's left over in the estate. And as I mentioned earlier, unless the RSP can be rolled into the RSP of a surviving spouse or purchased an annuity purchased for an infirm or dependent child, the estate is going to pay taxes on that RSP. And in effect, the residual beneficiaries will be paying that tax. So what I ask the client is, who are the beneficiaries of the residual estate? And if there's a difference between the beneficiary of the RSP and those of the residual of the estate, then I ask the client, do you want the estate to take on the burden of paying the tax, or do you want the beneficiary of the RSP to pay the tax that would be otherwise payable by the estate?
So it's a good idea, once again, for clients to understand, for people listening to us, understand that whether you have an RSP or a Registered Retirement Income Fund, a RIF as we call it, that it's very important to look at the beneficiary designations, as you said, to understand the taxation impact. Even if, for example, I mentioned this case, this client who had her two sons, and the one thing on her RIF was who were the beneficiaries? And she wasn't sure. And it was funny because at the end of the day, she wanted her kids to get the money. So if her kids are going to get the money, you should make sure that they're noted on the policy, you know, on the RIF, that they are there. Because if not, if it's somehow the estate of, then you're going to get into this whole issue of whether you're going to have to go through probate or not, or waltz around it. And not a bad idea that maybe that goes to the kids, because those monies will be paid out on death directly to the kids. And they may need the monies to take care of ordinary bills and everything else when a parent passes away.
The other benefit of designating the beneficiaries is there may be some creditor protection as well. So if the estate becomes bankrupt and and there is no beneficiary designated, those funds are subject to the claims of creditors. Whereas
now, Vince, what about this was asked to me. I don't know what your thought is. Somebody says, well, what if I name as my beneficiaries my three kids, but something happens to one of them before I die, or they die in a mutual car accident? Do my grandchildren, the children of that child, automatically get those monies on a?
I find that most plans will not allow you to designate a contingent beneficiary. That is, what happens if the first beneficiary dies?
Yeah.
You can do that with life insurance policies. With RSPs, I find it's very institution specific, but most of them will not allow for an alternate. So what happens in that case is if you have a child A, B, and C designated as the beneficiaries and child C dies, then A and B end up receiving all of the funds as between them. And C's heirs, if you will, or children will not receive any portion of those funds.
Yeah, and of course, this can cause a great deal of conflict within family settings, right? I mean, although people can always agree to do something different than what's in these policies, but it underlines, again, the importance of what we call life-changing events that people really consult with their lawyers to see what's going on. So usually the loss of a child is a life-changing event. And unfortunately, as lawyers, we see it from time to time. And it really is, I know clients always ask me, oh, Mr. Martinello, when do I need to have to come in and see you again? Well, the answer sometimes is it depends, right? If nothing changes much for 20 years, the wills that we've done 20 years, if they were done well, are probably still as good today as they were back then in basic principles. But if things change, like a child passes away, that's a life-changing event. A spouse dies, that's a life-changing event. One of your children or grandchildren become disabled, or a grandchild is born that has a particular disability. These are all life-changing events, and these are things that when they occur, it is important, for example, a parent or a grandparent to consider, I wonder how this all fits in to my overall estate planning. Would you agree with that, Vince?
I agree. As a rule of thumb, I always recommend to my clients a will review every 3 to 5 years, even if no changes are necessary. It's like your computer. It's a good idea to have your IT person check on it once in a while. I should point out, too, that if you appoint an attorney under power of attorney, there's a misconception that that attorney can make designations for you. That is not the case.
Because a lot of people, exactly what you just said, a lot of people think that if I'm a power of attorney for something, that I can do everything. I can make all these designations. I can even make my will for the person. Not correct at all.
You can't make any decision that's testamentary in nature. So your attorney has limited ability to make gifts during your lifetime while you're incapable of managing your property. But they can't make testamentary documents on your behalf. And the courts have considered beneficiary designations testamentary. So even if, give you an example, and unfortunately you really have no control over this. Let's say you have an RSP, you've made your designation, then you become incapacitated. Then you turn 71. Well, what happens then?
Mm-hmm.
The RSP is converted to a RIF. Well, the designation isn't automatic. You need to make that designation again. Unfortunately, your attorney can't make that designation for
because
you.
That seemed to be something in the it's nature of a testamentary disposition.
Exactly. And so I know as part of the Ontario Bar Association, I was on a committee. We made a submission to the Ontario government to allow for limited designations being made by the attorney in limited circumstances. Unfortunately, we haven't received any positive feedback or any feedback at all. But it would seem to be common sense to allow for that to happen. So unfortunately, there's certain things that even those of us who make the best of plans can't really have any control over.
Correct. And that's always very difficult and sort of emphasizes how lawyers who work in particular fields are often engaged in looking at how maybe to make the quote-unquote system better, because we see these things, as you just mentioned, where it just seems completely illogical. And people are definitely under the misimpression that having a power of attorney allows them to do anything, which seems in the broad general principle to be correct, but the devil's always in the details, as you mentioned. And that might be a reason to be devil's advocate instead of even mentioning children, where if a client knows that, they might say, you know what, I'm just going to make the beneficiary under my the estate. You know, just make it the estate. Whatever happens, I don't have to worry about all these kinds of details. Vince, have you ever heard that comment before?
Oh, of course, I've heard, especially where you have minor beneficiaries. Unless you go into some elaborate planning where you set up, I guess, a secret trust, if you will, you really need to have the proceeds paid to the estate, because if the minor beneficiary receives those funds while a minor, then those proceeds will have to be paid into court.
Right, and then we have the famous children's lawyer's office involved.
Exactly. And where it gets tricky is where you have some children who are over the age of 18, which is the age of majority in Ontario, and some who are under. And very often the clients simply designate the children regardless and hope for the best.
Yeah.
With the proviso that I give them that if that minor beneficiary were to receive that inheritance, then you're dealing with a government agency, which is always very cooperative. Overburdened and not very sympathetic to a parent or guardian wanting to have access to those funds without very, very strict requirements being met.
Well, that's great. So we're gonna take another 1 minute pause, and then when we come back in the context of minors and so on, we're gonna talk on the last third of the program about registered education savings plans in the contents of estate planning and whether there's any tax benefit or not relating to that. Thanks, Nick. Back in the Radio Maria studio with Joe Martinello and Vince DeAngelis talking about, in the famous program, we'll call it the famous program, called Ask the Lawyer. And we've been talking today about wills, estate planning, powers of attorney in the context of also taxation, which is coming, an important issue as everybody has to file tax returns. But one of the other things that comes up that no matter who our listeners are, whether they're parents or grandparents, that often are seen to be important is something called a Registered Education Savings Plan, or RESPs. Vince, we've seen a great proliferation of these plans over many, many years in either parents or grandparents putting away monies largely for, we'll call it post-secondary school education, although people don't realize it's not even necessarily just for university or community college. It can be things for like trade schools and other post-secondary institutions. So it's not just something for the wealthy elite, we'll call it, that can be taken advantage of, but can be a very practical thing for a lot of kids who are usually over 18 or 19 years old and trying to do something for themselves. So a lot of people feel, though, that if you, that this money, so let's say I establish a registered education savings plan for my grandchildren, because, you know, maybe my kids are busy with their own lives, paying off a mortgage, working hard, and, you know, maybe I'm a little bit older and I paid off my house mortgage and I got more money in the bank and I had my my RRSPs or my RIFs and maybe even my tax-free savings account, me and my wife, and so we're in a good situation. And I think, well, I want to do something for the grandchildren because, you know, I have the ability to do something and, you know, maybe someday they'll thank me very much for having helped them. Well, what do you think about the RRSP, Vince? And a good setup, issues that come up with them. Who do they belong to, these RRSP plans anyway?
Well, in terms of whether or not it's a good investment to make, again, I leave it to the financial planner to advise. Right. Because, again, you have to look at the client's financial circumstances, the needs of their family members, and, you know, what their tax situation is. But, you know, in general, our RESPs, basically, you know, the grandparent or parents can contribute up to a certain amount per year per child to an RESP. And there's an overall lifetime limit of $50,000.
$50,000, but there's no tax deduction for me, right?
There's no deduction, but the amount in the plan can earn income on a tax-free basis, and there's also government grants that are available to match the contributions up to a certain amount. For example, we have the Canada Education Savings Grant that's available.
Right, I think it's roughly $2,000 a year maximum.
It's 20% of the annual RESP contribution, so maximum, I believe, of $400 per child.
Right.
Lifetime maximum $7,200. That may have changed. But in any event, there are the matching government grants, which is a lot of people see that as an advantage when
right,
you set
can,
up the RESP,
can be
in addition to the deferral advantage.
Right, because a lot of these things occur, like in the case I used, if I'm the grandfather, I might do this when my grandchildren are quite young, right? And I have the ability to put the monies away, and that money can grow over a long period of time. So by the time they hit 18 or 19 years of age, it can be a substantial amount of money because education costs or even going to a trade school and so on can be very expensive, especially if there's not something in the city in which you live in.
And when the child is taking that money out for education purposes, for example, for tuition, they will generally have a lower level of income.
Normally,
so they'll be taxed
case.
At a lower rate because in Canada we pay tax, individuals pay taxes based on the graduated rate. So the more, depending on what your income bracket is, you pay a certain percentage of tax. So the benefit is you can't deduct the contributions, but they do grow tax-free. And to the extent that they do get paid to a child who's attending a post-secondary institution, they're taxed in the hands of that child.
And this
at
is
a
really,
lower rate.
And that's a big, very big deal because, as you said, it's very rare to see an 18 or 19 or a 20-year-old who has earned a huge amount of money because it's a lot harder to get jobs during the summer, good-paying jobs during the summer, even if they work. And so essentially, with the grant that comes in from the government and the effect of compounding, again, makes a big, big difference on a long term. So if you start early, you can go for a long term. Are there any other benefits, Vince, that you've seen with RESPs aside from that?
Well, I think, again, it perhaps provides an incentive for that child. Perhaps it's some money that's available that wouldn't otherwise.
Now, what happens if that child doesn't use that money? I mean, who does it just belong to the kids or...
Well,
is it my money or whose money is it actually at the end of the day?
Well, there's certain tax consequences. The contributor can get the principal payments back. The government grants would have to be returned, and there would be a tax, the highest marginal rate on any amount that grew in the plan over the course of its lifetime. And I believe there's an additional tax on top of that. So the penalties are quite high. Mm-hmm. Although there is the ability, if you do have RSP room, you can basically roll that money into your RSP if you have room.
So that
and
can
so
be,
there wouldn't
that can
be any tax consequences.
So that could be another strategy. In other words, somebody, like I said, the grandfather again, or maybe someone who was in their late 50s would say, well, I have the ability to maybe help my grandchildren out on the long term. And so for whatever reason, maybe on the whole balance of things, I'd rather help them than give myself a current tax break. But if I need to in the future, I'd be able to use it. It's not throw away money, right? It's not, I could get my capital back if I wanted to. I could let the growth maybe go to them, or I could then maybe even convert it, as you said, into an RSP later on. So that's fairly valuable, I would think.
Yeah, and there's other options to roll the monies too. But I think the RSP is the main one, and certainly that's a benefit that's available.
Now, what about, we've touched a little bit about it. I know it's a whole big topic, but certainly what we see more and more with clients today, even children or grandchildren, are kids or whatever who have certain disabilities, right? We see that a lot more. So are there also something that we can do to address those kinds of situations where kids are have a particular disability? Or how would you, you know, does your antenna, your legal antenna goes up every time you hear about Mr. X who has a grandchild who's autistic or has a learning disability of a sort?
Well, I think we talked about government programs that are available in our last show.
Right.
The primary one in Ontario is the Ontario Disability Savings Plan. And that has certain income and asset limits, which were raised recently. Assuming those...
I'm sorry, I don't remember them. They used to be around $5,000. They've been raised to...
I believe it's $40,000 per person.
Right.
And there is an ability to take monies out of a trust that may have been set up for that child up to $10,000 in a 12-month period.
Right. So that's a substantial increase in dollars.
Substantial increase. Again, what is excluded and what is not included or what is included as an asset depends. There are, I think we talked about trusts. We talked about Henson trusts.
Mm-hmm.
Another asset that's excluded from the calculation of assets for purpose of ODSP is the Registered Disability Savings Plan.
Oh, right.
So and like the RESP, contributions can be, it can be set up by a disabled person, a parent, or a legal representative. So there's restrictions in terms, like the RSP, there's only a certain class of people that can set it up. And once it's been set up, anybody can contribute to the plan for the benefit of the beneficiary to a lifetime maximum of $200,000. And that's not considered an asset for ODSP purposes. And like the RESP, contributions to the contributions to the RDSP also qualify for matching government grants, which depending on the family net income, because they look at the family overall, could be up to 300 times the contribution made by family members. So there is that benefit as well. And again, like the RESP, the income accumulates tax-free in the RDSP.
Okay, well, that's really important to point out again when we talk about life-changing events where somebody either has or something occurs that of that nature, which needs to be addressed, how important it is to get professional financial planning and, of course, legal advice relating to it. Vince, before we close the program for today, I wanted to bring out one other matter which I find sometimes people, a lot of times clients don't understand, maybe it merits even a little bit more discussion on another program, this whole question of when you're going through the wills and estates information return, and then out of that, this has happened to me so many times, I scratch my head, and it's happened with me particularly with the Italian clients that I have, which you would appreciate, because in Italian we have this expression, I'll translate it very literally. It's dare soldi, means to give money to somebody, but it doesn't really mean to give money, you know? It's like something gets lost in the translation. And so when I've had, especially Italian-speaking clients, I'm sure it's in, it happens in all cultures, when they say that they, I gave my son this money, it's giving in the context like I cut a check. But the question I have always asked is it really a gift or is it really a loan? I don't know if you see that, but more and more I'm seeing that. And sometimes I get the response, well, of course, if I want the money back, I have to be paid back. Well, as lawyers, we know that there's a difference between a true gift and a true loan. And so what do you do when you have preferred a child or grandchild in one way or not another? Are you seeing this issue of gifting and loaning something when you're going through their situation? Because if, for example, I have quote-unquote given $200,000 to a child or grandchild, there could be other people who are interested and they're going to eventually say, well, that really wasn't a gift. That was really a loan. Do you ever deal with those issues with your clients?
Well, that becomes more and more common these days, and especially when there's son-in-law or daughter-in-law involved.
Mm-hmm.
It really comes down to what is the intent of the client. And, you know, these things, when if and when they do end up in court, really do focus on the issue of what was the parent's intention. And so my advice to the client is to, you know, document that intention. If it's a gift, set it out in a document saying it's a gift. And they should also
specify. And if it's
specify,
a loan, say it's a loan.
Say it's a loan. Do you want security for the loan in the sense that do you want an assurance that the money will be repaid? Because if you lend the money, even if you have an IOU, if that child doesn't have the money anymore, you may be out of luck trying to get it back. So do you take security, i.e. a mortgage on the home? And the courts are scrutinizing these types of arrangements, especially when there is a son-in-law or daughter-in-law involved. And so it's not enough just to make the loan and to document it. It's important to have regular payments made on the loan. Because the courts have gone to say, well, you, mom and dad, didn't do anything about this loan. You didn't ask for the money back until 20 years later when the marriage broke down. So you obviously didn't need it. You intended it to be a gift. And there's no logic behind that reasoning. I mm-hmm. just think it's bad facts making bad law, and the judges just want to be fair. To me, that's not, with respect, the right way to go about it, but unfortunately, that's what we're dealing with. So it's important to document the intention and to put it in, especially where it's a loan, into a viable document, one that's going to be enforced 10, yeah. 20 years down the road.
Yeah, and maybe to do that, it may be to put something into the will itself to talk about loans, or money's advanced, we'll say, to children in particular.
It wouldn't be a bad idea to buttress that by saying that, you know, any amounts that were given, you know, to state that this amount of money that was given to my child and son-in-law and daughter-in-law has to be repaid or it's forgiven.
And I guess contrary to that also, if you really don't want the money to come into your estate on death, is to put something in the will where you basically forgive all the loans that you've had a moment before you passed away or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah. Very good. Thanks, Vince, for being in studio today. We're nearing the end of our time for today's presentation. We hope you've all enjoyed it and it's stimulated some thought. And we hope to hear from you next month when we'll be talking. We're not sure about what, but we'll be talking about various legal themes that we hope are of interest to all of our listeners. And now we will send everything back to Nick in our Radio Maria studio. Thanks, Nick.
You have been listening to Ask the Lawyer, hosted by Joe Martinello. Here on Radio Maria Canada, a Catholic voice wherever you are.